Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to Christopher McQuarrie's Mission Impossible Fallout, aka the sixth movie in the Mission Impossible movie franchise. Now, of course, this one is more of an amuse-bouche, a little bite-sized palate cleanser, if you will, in between the monster podcasts that are my sit-downs with Chris McQuarrie on either side of the Atlantic. You may have already heard the near three-hour epic that was part one. I'll get ready next week for part two, which would be about 2 hours as well. And so, talking about the movie is Team Empire over the next 38 minutes or so. Just a light dash, if you will, of a podcast. And we're going to be answering your questions and talking about our own feelings about the movie as well. And joining me to do so over the next few minutes, Helen O'Hara, who wrote the five-star review.
Hello.
Nick DeSemlian.
Hello.
Who has seen all the Mission Impossible movies.
Thank you. My fifth reload as well. They don't.
And our very own nefarious double agent, a.k.a. August Walker. No, I don't know what your name is.
James Dyer.
Hello. August Dyer. How are you?
I'm good. My plans for world domination are coming together nicely.
Are you more Solomon Lane than August Walker, I would say?
I don't know. We'd have to see him with a moustache.
I like to think of myself as an August Walker, but perhaps I'm kidding myself and I'm more of a Sean Harris.
I think if any of us try to do the thing that Cavill does with that reloading arms thing, we would look so stupid. I can't even begin to tell you.
My arms would fall off.
Nick just said he can do it.
I can do it.
Go on, Nick. Let's do it now. Reload your arms. I know this is a podcast, but we'll judge.
Yeah, that was terrible.
That was very impressive.
Wow.
On the plus side, my upper lip is CGI.
All right. So
is that genuinely impressive?
No. Oh. I hate to break it to you, but no. Right, anyway, so we don't have a lot of time, but we do have a lot of your questions, and we do have, I think, a shared love of this movie, which is good. Should we just go straight into the questions?
Sure.
All right, so the questions are going to be a little bit all over the shop, but there you go. So the first one is from Henry Davis, and he asks, do you think the trailer showed too much? I felt like it hampered my enjoyment, especially with Luther at the beginning. Now, given that the trailer gives away pretty much all the major twists and turns and things like the helicopter chase. Oh, and by the way, we should point out, spoiler special. If you haven't seen the film, stop listening, because we're getting straight into it, ending stuff right from the off. So if you haven't seen Mission Impossible Fallout, stop the podcast, go and see the film, and then come back again. All right? Good? Happy? Done.
Yes.
Right, so what do we think? Because it gives away, that those trailers give away an awful lot.
I disagree. I actually came out of this film and one of the first things I said was I was so happy the marketing was done so well and it didn't give away all the money shots in the movie and all the twists and turns. And I thought a couple of films did this summer. Infinity War did a really good job of hiding a lot of stuff as well. I thought Jurassic World was the worst offender in terms of giving stuff away. But I didn't feel that.
Okay.
Not just the trailer, but the trailer within the film gives you glimpses of a lot of the action sequences to come as well.
The credit sequence.
Yeah.
That I love that tradition, though.
They don't do it on Mission Impossible 2. I've been rewatching them. Mission Impossible 2 is the only one not to do that.
Is it? I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
Who would have thought?
Yes. Yeah. I agree you could maybe have left the helicopter sequence out of the trailers without losing a vast amount, I think, but that might have involved putting in too much of the other ones, so maybe they struck the right balance there.
It is an interesting one because the trailers, especially as they went along, gave away the fact that Walker is a bad guy, or at least the antagonist of the movie. It doesn't fully go, this dude is full on evil and wants to, you know, bring about, well, not the end of the world, but very, very close. But it certainly does set him up as an antagonist to Ethan Hunt. Now, do you think, I've seen some people lament that and they would have liked that to have been revealed as the movie went along.
He's introduced as an antagonist. Like, the very first scene is in, it's pretty clear that they're going to be butting heads.
But then they could butt heads without being enemies. Like, it could be a sort of, like, because I think in the first half of the movie, there is a suggestion it's almost going to be like a buddy cop thing. Like, you start off butting heads, but by God, I respect you.
I assumed that he would be sent after Ethan at some point by the CIA or whatever, and that was going to be the dynamic. I knew he was going to be chasing him, but I didn't know that he was going to be a proper baddie.
I think that's right. I assumed the same, or at least didn't assume the same, but thought that was a possibility. But I think that they they could have hidden a little bit better that he was going to turn quite as far as he did. I think, you know, it could have been the I've been sent after you to bring you in more than the suspicion I think many people had that he was the bad guy that he would be fighting in the final scene.
See, it's interesting because I kind of thought a bit like you guys that there would be a bit of redemption, that there'd be a buddy movie archetype going on here, that, you know, they would finally find in the final reel that Solomon Lane was the threat that they had to unite to fight, and that they might put aside their differences. And I, especially, I'll be honest, when Cavill was first cast, I thought that he was, in a way, the setting up of the passing of the torch of this franchise.
The same way people thought for Jeremy Renner. Yeah.
And I still feel that Renner was introduced with that in mind. In Ghost Protocol, less so obviously in Rogue Nation, but there's certainly a thing that's going on that maybe Tom Cruise particularly is just going, oh, this is my franchise now and I'm leaning into it and I'm loving it and you're going to have to pry it out of my cold dead hands when I'm 75.
But then on the other hand, I think in this film, maybe more than any of the others, he acknowledges a certain amount of wear and tear.
A fragility,
And I think some of that is coming obviously from the fact that, you know, he literally broke his leg during the shoot, and maybe that changed how they approached some stuff. But it seems to be the whole way through the film. It seems to be there that, you know, he is, there's a sense of effort on his part, and he's still doing impossible things, but they hurt. And I got the impression that he's not oblivious to the passing of time, that he's willing to acknowledge it as a character beat, if nothing else.
There's a shot in the trailer, which is not in the film, isn't there? The truck collision, or what looks like a collision.
That's correct, yes. That's correct. And that is, as that's mentioned in the first part of the Macquarie thing, and that is a shot from the helicopter chase towards the end that was cut out when Ethan dips down beneath the clouds and comes into contact with the truck and then quickly goes up and emerges from the clouds. So yeah. But I don't think that had Cavill in it. That was just a random guy in a truck, as far as I can tell. But the Cavill thing, I really do think is interesting. I think that's a really great character. I think August Walker, he plays it brilliantly. You know, there's no vestige of Superman in this performance.
Well, I think what's really interesting is I think we've kind of found his niche a little bit with this. Not, which is not to say he shouldn't and couldn't do other things, but I think all of that ridiculous handsomeness actually works a lot better in this than it does in almost anything else he's ever been cast in. Even as Superman, like we've talked about this in spoiler specials for his two Superman films, but there's an element of sometimes he can look a little bit smugger than Superman should, whereas here that works so well. And all of that kind of patrician, perfect, you know, Ubermensch kind of good looks plays nicely here as a bad guy, because, you know, if you were put up against this guy, you'd be hard pressed not to hate him. If you were, you know, in a position where you had to measure yourself against him, you're really up against it. And I think that's just really, really good casting.
I have an August Walker.
August Walker. Yeah.
I have a question about him, but is there a question about him later on?
I'd ask it.
So, the skydiving sequence when he passes out and, you know, looks like he's being a bit of an idiot. Is that part of his plan?
No, he's out cold.
Yeah. He gets struck by lightning. Yeah.
But does he do it? Does he knock himself out on purpose for some reason?
No. He gets struck by lightning. I mean, that's pretty hard to do on purpose unless you're Thor.
Because we're sort of led to believe later in the movie that he's this sort of brilliant, undercover, legendary figure. Mm-hmm. But that's quite a stupid thing to do.
But he's also a bit of an idiot.
Yeah, he's also...
evidenced.
He's reckless.
You know, I don't know how much that was a kind of facade that he was putting on.
I think he's also the hammer. Like, he's not necessarily the mastermind planner. I think, you know, he's certainly very smart, but I think that's more Solomon Lane still. Mm. I think he is the fixer. He's the guy who goes in and gets shit done. And I think his jumping out of the plane like, no, fuck off, we're just going to do this, is very much part of that side of his character rather than the planning.
I don't need your warnings. Exactly. You know, he's very much, I don't believe in experts. Who needs experts? And he just leaps and immediately... The fact that he immediately gets hit by lightning made me laugh a lot. Oh, fuck off, Ethan. And I think a few people have sent in this observation as well, that this is... More than anything else, even more than The Man from U.N.C.L.E., his audition for Bond. And the thing I like about Henry Cavill is that he is not backwards and coming forwards about his wanting to be James Bond, which you don't often see. I don't even think that Michael Fassbender has publicly come out and gone, X-Men First Class, that was me wanting to be James Bond. We know that the role's going to be vacated. Honestly, if they're not looking at him as an option, once Daniel Craig hangs up the Walter PPK, then they're, you know, they need to, their heads examined. I think.
I disagree.
Helen
anyway.
Completely agrees.
I think he can do better.
I don't think he should be Bond.
Any reason? Are you just going to leave it at that?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, good. I'm won over to your argument.
No one should get to be Superman and Bond. That's greedy.
Superman and Bond and August Walker and Napoleon Solo and that bloke from Immortals. Right. Here's a question from Daniel Gaze at Piccolo135. And he asks, as Benji jokes to death, while Ilsa deals with Lane, it was clearly a reference to the idea of looking out for one person over the greater good. But did she stop a kill to help Benji? Or was it the greater good?
The greater good.
I know. Or was the intention to put him to sleep and then help, thereby cutting her close and showing that she won't make the same choices that Hunt does?
She's torn, isn't she? You can see she's torn between the two things. She wants to kill him and she wants to save Benji. Mm. And then she splits the difference and chokes him into unconsciousness and then just saves Benji.
Yeah, I think she's trying to do both as efficiently as possible.
Women are good multitaskers. I think she demonstrates that well.
Yeah, well.
What do we think of Ilsa in this movie? Do you think she was introduced at the right time? Could have been introduced earlier? Could have been introduced later? And that relationship with Ethan as it developed?
I had a little bit of a problem with her characterization in this movie, in that a lot of the beats felt very similar to Rogue Nation. The sort of, you know, you'll be disavowed, you can never go home thing was exactly the threat that they had over her in Rogue Nation. And I was like, what? So MI6 only has one thing? Like, there's nothing else that they will threaten anybody with? Mm. So that slightly annoyed me. But the bigger problem I had, I think, was that she and Ethan didn't trust one another earlier. Because actually, when she actually talked to him, it didn't seem like there was that much reason not to have told him that several scenes before. And I wasn't quite sure why she didn't.
Right.
So I would have liked to have seen them team up earlier. Not necessarily for her to appear any earlier, but just a bit more honesty early on. Maybe it's because August was there when they first
met, or was hovering. Yeah.
But
yeah, I think that's it. I'm not sure if I've asked Macquarie this or not, because the second part hasn't happened yet. But when she shoots the man who's pretending to be Lark in the toilet scene, and she sees Ethan, she goes, shit. Now, that shit could be read a couple of ways. One is that she just shot the dude without knowing it was Ethan. Or two, that she knows by shooting the man pretending to be Lark that she has in some way fucked things up. Mm. Now, what's your take?
I think you're supposed to think it's the former, but it is in fact the latter, because I think she shoots him specifically because it's Ethan. Mm. But yeah, it's a nice bit of misdirection, because it can be read either way.
Mm. I thought this movie really nicely progresses our relationship to the point where we can expect some impossible positions coming up in the not too distant future.
But nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Say no more.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Because in Rogue Nation, Ethan's wife is not mentioned or seen at any point. And you're left at that point wondering, is he still married? What's going on? I don't really know what's happening.
And the answer was no, he wasn't.
And the answer was no, it's all in the past.
He was married to fake out Wes Bentley.
Because it sounds funny, but all the way through Rogue Nation watching it, and like they're flirting with each other, and I felt a little bit like, aren't you married? I'm pretty sure I saw you get married. And I like the fact that they dealt with it in this. Yeah. I thought it was a really nice touch to bring her in and do that sequence at the end.
Because there's ambiguity, isn't there? Because she shows up at the end of Ghost Protocol, or where Ethan is looking on her, looking at her from afar, and clearly. And then, I was also a little bit annoyed with that in Rogue Nation. And what's happening there? What's going on with that? But and I'm glad that it was resolved.
I also liked in Rogue Nation that you thought, you know what, this even though it's a bit flirty fun, there wasn't necessarily a love story there. Yeah. They were working together. They were both professionals. I mean, he was clearly, you know, shall we say, a little bit taken with that, because he makes a number of incredibly stupid decisions which seem motivated by thinking with his penis. But not to put too fine a point on it, the thinking, not the penis. But in this, you know, I thought it was more balanced. Although I will say, and I loved this film, the only bit that I perhaps slightly, not cringed at, but registered, was when Luther explains Ethan's marital situation to Ilsa. I felt that dialogue a bit on the nose. That little speech he gives, I was like, I might have done that a bit differently. But
sorry, you tell Chris McQuarrie how to write.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yes,
he'll come in and tell us how to polish.
The man who wrote The Usual Suspects. I'm going to give him advice on how to do a screenplay. No, it's just it wasn't. No, I'm going to blame it all on Ving Rhames.
The delivery.
No, I don't know. It felt a little bit pointed. That I wondered whether maybe it was for time, but it felt kind of a blunt way of conveying that information.
I liked it.
Yeah, I liked the evolution in this movie because Luther is. Yeah, a character I don't know necessarily sometimes the films have known what to do with, that they feel sometimes they have to have him around. But he shows up at the end of Ghost Protocol just to keep the run going. That's the feeling there. And this one, you feel that Ving Rhames has aged and matured. I think he's either late 50s or early 60s now. And he's become the wise old soul of the franchise in a strange way. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he has the most soulful, emotional moments, both with Ilsa and then with Julia. He has those moments, and I think he can sell it in a way that I don't think Benji would necessarily have the experience to do so.
But unlike Mission Impossible 2, there isn't a scene where he steps in shit and goes, shit.
Well, we can't have everything.
Yeah.
I need a revisit too.
2 is astonishing. Yeah. I believe it's kangaroo poo as well.
I think I'm rewatching them. I was going to watch them all before Fallout, and instead I watched Fallout, and now I've just watched Rogue Nation, so I think I'm now doing them all in reverse order, and I'm going to end with the first one.
I've watched them all multiple times, except for 2, which I've just watched once when it came out, and I didn't like it.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel a little bit trepidatious about going back in again.
It's not that bad. It's fine.
He has got exploding hair in it.
And actually, we were talking about the most stunning visual image of the whole series. I would make a case for him hanging off the rock in 2.
Why is he in Australia? What's going on?
Why is he on holiday?
Yeah, but then the whole plot is on Australia
as well. I don't think he's meant to be in Australia at that point, is he?
Oh, he's in Utah or somewhere, isn't he?
He's in Death Valley or something.
Right.
Not Death Valley, the other one. Monument
Life Valley.
I think they shot it in Australia, but yeah, maybe.
Is it 2 who has my favourite Hopkins line, it's not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt.
Yes,
I didn't say that properly. I'm sorry.
It's not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt.
Stop.
Watch me in Westworld.
Right. I hate you all. I fucking hate you all. You can just leave that in there because fuck you.
A census taker once tried to test me, Mr. Hunt.
Anthony Hopkins, yeah.
Anthony Hopkins,
Mission Impossible.
One man can do, another can do. Say, wait, Bob, sir, you're not a king, you're not a king. And I killed the motherfucker.
But it's got 2 has got exploding Ray-Bans. Why are we talking about Mission Impossible 2? I feel like this is my fault. Oh, let's go back to Luther! James, do you want to give us your Ving Rhames?
No, you know what? You've taught me around. He's brilliant. That scene was brilliant. I loved it.
Can we talk about how energetic sex is going to be between Ethan Hunt and Ilsa Faust?
Extraordinary.
And what? Does, like, and the lengths Ethan will go to make it interesting in the bedroom.
Good Lord.
What's he going to climb?
Yeah. What's he going to leap off?
He's going to make some kind of Faustian pact.
What masks is he going to wear? That kind of thing. Mm. Do they have masks for penises? Can he put a bigger penis onto his penis?
Slight intervention. Just masks is an interesting thing because they've kind of changed up they've changed up the mask creation technique.
Yes.
In this film, because it changes from film to film.
Yes.
And
almost as if it was not consistent.
Is it 2 or 3?
They're always streamlining and improving the process.
It's 2 or 3 where they have to carry around this massive device to build it. But then in this one, it's mobile. It's in a briefcase, which I quite liked. I loved that whole scene in I actually think the toilet scene has made my favourite sequence in the film because it's just brilliant the way it builds.
With a group of homophobes come in and stop banging on the door.
It's ridiculous that it's a really, really busy club and no one comes in for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, that did sound like
the VIP section.
Where's the man with the aftershaves and the sweets?
Maybe it's not one of those.
Maybe they asked him to leave first.
Yeah. But I really enjoyed, Walker just smashing the guy in the face, breaking the machine.
Yeah, because he's the hammer.
Yeah,
but also you see, he's also thinking ahead.
Is he?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Presumably, right?
I just thought he was being a.
I mean, I think a bit blunt of both instrument. Possibly, but I think it doesn't hurt his plans that the face machine is then out of action.
Yeah, but there wasn't that they used the masks extremely well in this film.
Yeah.
Yes. Benji in particular.
2 big switcheroos.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to say I fell for both of them. I didn't predict either.
I did too. Yeah. Both, even the second time I watched a movie.
Weird.
Got me as well.
Still surprised.
Still surprised.
Weirdly, I was suspicious of both.
You were? You saw them, you sniffed them coming?
I kind of did a little bit, yeah.
Never trust a man who created Kaiser Soze. That's Helen's
that's
motto.
My motto. Yeah.
Go into this movie knowing...
I actually got that tattooed on my ankle, I did. Yeah.
But Great Wolf Blitzer, you know.
That has got to be cameo of the year so far.
Yeah,
Blitzer v. Walker.
Yeah. CNN dispensing fake news.
It was literally fake news, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't get it until I think it was 3 minutes after he'd pulled his mask off to reveal that it was Benji. I was sitting there thinking, "Well, this is a bold gambit," because I'd spoken to Macquarie on set and then in the run up for the feature, and he talked about how this movie's about literally the fallout of Ethan's good intentions and how fallout means something on a couple of levels, and suddenly the second scene you have nuclear bombs going off, and I thought, wow, they've really escalated.
You thought they were going all Sum of All Fears?
I thought they were going Sum of All Fears.
Or 24 season 2. Very rarely do they actually set a nuke off in things, but I fell for it.
Yeah, so did I. And so indeed did a generic bad guy as evil nuclear...
Professor
Bomalot.
Professor Bomalot.
Sven
can I just
Bomalot.
Say, Sven at the beginning Bomalot. Of this... When they give the breakdown of, you know, the syndicate is essentially dissolved, these are the apostles, I was just like, what the fuck is going on? I didn't follow any of that.
Did anyone?
But it didn't matter.
It wasn't complicated.
No, but yeah. I guess maybe I just wasn't paying attention, but there was something about apostles, and then this guy in the hospital, I was like, who are you?
It's
and
like,
just,
it was,
what's happening?
It was all very clearly laid out. And it's basically Hydra, you know, you cut off one head, a bunch of heads arise.
See, I'd be a terrible IMF agent, because they'd be like, your mission, should you... And I'd be like, no, I'm on HQ, it's question three,
And this... I don't know what
and
you
there's
said.
A thing of self-destruct, and I have no idea what to do.
Now I'm stuck in Belfast and I can't get out. what's happening?
By the way, that was not a convincing Belfast, I didn't think.
It was raining.
No, yeah. Well, no, yeah, you're right, because the guy didn't come along and go, hey, how about you there now, wee man? I've got a mission for you.
Here, I didn't see a single packet of potatoes.
No, or feta bread.
No, none.
Or a sectarian hatred. There was nothing going on. But nothing going on there.
The ancient works of Homer are deeply popular.
That is true. Yes. So
here's a copy of Homer's Odyssey. Love Homer. Doh!
And that's the choice of the book is I mean, it went over my head, but I'm presuming there's some thematic.
Helen has. I haven't asked Macquarie that yet. Yep. So Helen will feel this. She feels that there may be some comparisons.
Well, we were reaching in our conversation.
Jack reaching.
Yeah.
We were Jack reaching in our conversation. And I guess if you really want there to be parallels, then you've got Julia as sort of Penelope, the wife waiting at home. You maybe have either Ilsa or the White Widow. I can't remember which one we came down as Circe. I think it was the White Widow as Circe.
Yep.
And Henry Cavill gets one side of his face burned. So if he just lost an eye, damn it, he would have been the Cyclops. It would have all fit. I mean, I don't know. There's a thing. You can twist it to fit, but I'm not entirely sure it's meant to be there.
But I think the winner in all this is Homer, who's going to be getting some sweet royalties now.
Mm.
Right. I just want to tell you something about contract terms, Chris, that may come as a bit of a shock.
And mortality.
Yes. Chris, you may want to be sitting down for this, but Homer is dead.
No! Don't!
Jimbo, you were going to say something.
I couldn't even begin to guess at this point.
All right. So if anyone's listened to the Macquarie piece before Liz, this is a slight contrast, I have to say. All right, here's another question. This comes from at Tristan L. Intern. Oh, no, Tristan Lintern. The stunts that are pulled off in the film and the technology and techniques behind them are beyond astonishing and on a whole other level. Wait a minute, this is Chris Macquarie. As a film geek who takes in all the film discussion, I love hearing how it was accomplished. For the average film patron, do you think enough is on the screen for them to appreciate the stunt accomplishments? Or do you think the average audience member will just put it down to clever CGI like everything else we've seen?
I think there's a sequence when the two helicopters collide, which is clearly CGI. And it was jarring for me because I'm like, oh, yes, I remember computer graphics. Because at that point, I didn't feel like I'd really seen any. And then you go straight from that, and I think I watched the trailer for Crimes of Grindelwald, and it's a big, obviously, CG fest because magic isn't real. And
what?
Sorry, Helen. But I loved the fact that so much of this either was or very much seemed practical.
Yeah.
And just after every action sequence, I was just like, how on earth did they do that?
Do you know what really impressed me most? And I've said this to some of you guys I know already. It's the fact that he goes around the Place de l'Étoile, around the Arc de Triomphe, on a motorbike in a chase scene. Now, let me just explain to you why that's insane. There are 12 avenues that meet around the Arc de Triomphe. There are no lane markings anywhere on the square because it would spoil the effect of there's actually a star laid out in the pavement. It would spoil the effect, so they don't have any lane markings. So you've got 12 roads all coming onto this gigantic circular roundabout around the monument. And everyone drives like a maniac because they're all French. So, and I'm not kidding, if you drive onto that roundabout as a normal person on a normal day and you have an accident, you are 50% responsible because you drove onto it.
Yeah. It's famously for its numerous accidents every day.
If you go up to the top of the Arc de Triomphe and you lean over and you look out, you will 100% see a car crash at some point if you're up there long enough, right? It just happens. And they did an action sequence around that, actually. You know, obviously at the early hours of the morning when they were able to control it, but that is still mental to me. Absolutely crazy. Their Parisian geography is off, but that doesn't matter. It's great.
Although I'm told that the run through London was, apparently it's our art director Chris Lupton's commute. So
some of that is pretty solid.
That's why he's always up the top of the table.
Yeah, that's how he gets to work. He literally runs across the top of it.
Wow.
That's across the top of Blackfriars.
Yeah.
Very similar to that run through London, very similar to Mission Impossible 3, the scene near the end where Benji is directing him through China, which is, I'm sure, deliberate. That's sort of a callback in a way.
In fact, someone has timed that and said that there's a shot in MI3 that it's the longest continuous shot of Tom Cruise running in a movie yet. And I feel like the shot in this movie, which I think is a composite shot of two different shots stitched together, where Cruise is running just before he breaks his ankle in real life. That shot, I think that has been deliberately timed to be 1 second longer. And I don't know that for sure yet. I haven't asked Macquarie that yet. But the Beatles did that actually with Hey Jude. Hey Jude was timed to be, I believe, 1 second longer than the previous record holder for the longest number one.
Blues Brothers, Blues Brothers 2000. I think the first Blues Brothers film, there were like 143 cars totaled. Yeah. And Blues Brothers 2000 added one extra car.
Yeah, just to be clear.
So
they've since been surpassed by one of the Fast and Furious movies, but you're right, Blues Brothers 2000 broke Blues Brothers' record.
Yeah. But it's a very, very good point. I do feel, actually, that a lot of people will think this is all CG. And, you know, at a certain point, as filmmakers, they must be going, well, why bother?
I don't think it matters what people think. I think that if it's done well, you don't think about how it was done. You just kind of are in there. And I didn't actually, it wasn't one of those films where I was going, oh, I wonder how they did that or that. I just kind of went along with it.
Just when he the camera's on Cruise's face and he turns and he runs and jumps out of the plane and it follows him down, that was insane. When he's pelting through traffic on the motorbike, I mean, the same thing's true in Rogue Nation, and you see his face very clearly front on as he's bombing along on a motorbike without a fucking helmet on, and it's just like, oh my God.
Yeah,
like,
it's crazy.
How is he insured?
But it reminds me of an anecdote I think Keanu Reeves told when he was making Speed. And that he was terrified during the bit where Jack is trying to get onto the bus and he's driving through the rush hour traffic. And he's like, well, what if I smash into these guys? And the stunt guy, the head of the stunt team was like, these are the best stunt drivers in the world. You couldn't hit them if you tried. So it's totally fine. So like every little thing that we think is an accident in that sequence where there's a moment where someone swerves into traffic and he swerves around them really, really quickly. It looks amazing, but timed within just an inch of its life. Just extraordinary stuff. So Jorge Castillo at J.I. Castillo asks, who should be the next IMF boss? Renner? Cruise himself?
Where was Renner?
Just not in it.
He was,
for no particular reason.
Look, he and Hawkeye were off on a golf course somewhere.
Was he under house arrest? That's the question. Yes.
It should be Tom Cruise playing his Tropic Thunder character. just that he's now an IMF boss.
That would be terrible on so many levels. My God. It did occur to me sometimes just because he is, you know, he's over 50 and showing the pain now. I did wonder if at some point he'll take a desk job and be in charge of the IMF, but I actually don't see it happening anytime soon.
He'll still be running in his 80s, absolutely. Yeah. Ian McKellen, because he was meant to play Anthony Hopkins' role in Mission Impossible 2.
Good shout.
He couldn't do it, or rather he decided not to do it at the last minute, and put him in there, in his cat's costume, possibly.
Would you want to see anyone come back? Lawrence Fishburne from MI3, and of course the beloved Kittredge from Mission Impossible.
Big fan of Fishburne's work. I liked him in MI3. He'd bleed on the flag to keep those stripes red.
We're talking about intelligence, but I'm not seeing any. Horribly misquoted that. But
And his excellent line about eating chocolate.
Yes. He's an unstoppable zing machine.
Yeah, he really is.
He's incredible in that. I had to stop the scene and rewind it the other night when I was watching it. Bring them all back. Bring them all of them. All of them. Bring back Tom Wilkinson. Did he survive that one?
No, he was well killed.
Bring yeah, it, bring super it back.
Proper super shot in the head.
Well, it wasn't really him. Bring back Emilio Estevez and Kristen Scott Thomas.
You never see the body. Well, apart from the fact you do. You totally do.
Bring back everyone. Bring back the fish from the first one, the fish tank.
Yeah, bring them all back. Do you think that, were you sad to see Alec Baldwin go? I expected him, honestly, to stick around for a couple of films.
I was surprised.
Given the rigmarole getting him into the job in the first place.
I think maybe they've been hesitant, I think, for the last few films to kill anybody too close to Hunt on the basis that he lost his entire team in the first one and they wanted to maybe give him a break. But I think it was probably time for somebody to go.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to lose Benji personally. And I'm glad that the fake outs were fake outs vis-a-vis Benji, although there were kind of a few.
You can't kill Benji. You can't kill him.
You could try.
They do.
Woe betide you, should you try. Here's a question from at Miss US Pops. Is this the last we've seen of Vanessa Kirby, or is she now well placed to take a further role in the franchise?
I think they're setting her up for more, actually. I think, first of all, I get that impression from her, and second of all, I just get that impression from the way it was left. She is, of course, we haven't talked about it, but just in case anyone didn't pick up on the fact that she keeps talking about Max and her legacy from Max in her opening speech, that would, of course, refer back to Vanessa Redgrave's character in the very first Mission Impossible. So there's a sense of kind of familial lineage there. And from what she was saying about some of the deleted scenes from this film, that the character went back and forth a bit, and, of course, there was stuff that they didn't have time for. Mm-hmm. But there was one scene which was almost a sort of setting her up as a kind of a dark mirror to Ethan, that she's in a situation that she maybe didn't choose, where she's inherited this mantle as a power broker and an arms dealer, maybe wouldn't have wanted it and maybe would like to escape. And that there's a sort of sense of her not having a choice, whereas he always has a choice to accept his mission in theory. I don't know if she's necessarily set up that way to become some kind of good guy or sympathetic person, because she's clearly got a psychotic streak in her a mile wide. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think there's interesting stuff there to explore potentially going forward.
I want to see a scene where Ethan emails her, just as he did her mother in the first movie.
Usenet.
Yes, and takes ages for the email to go through, and then he has to wait online for a reply to come. That would be cool. Yeah, I think we're going to see more of her in the next one. Here's a question from at Mr. Ken Shabby, a.k.a. John Rain of the Smirsh Pod. Is the bit where Hunt in his big chopper looks over at Walker in the opposite chopper and calls him a prick the most satisfying moment in 2018's films?
It's up there. It really is up there.
Someone was suggesting that that someone should dub in Danny Dyer's twat from Newsnight. Twat.
Which you need to be able to count for it.
That's good. That's
twat.
That's a good use of profanity. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I love a good use of profanity.
Cruise improv.
Really?
Yep. I didn't know that Cruise knew such bad words.
Wow.
Apart from, just ignore the whole of Magnolia. Time that and respect that.
What you can't see at home is that Chris just did gestures.
They are.
did I?
Yes, you did. And they are burned respect into my eyes.
And
yeah, you did. Yeah. Were you aware of it that time?
Yeah, a little bit more. But do we think that Tom Cruise knows bad words, or do we think that they have to be added in ADR afterwards as someone else, which is why they all sound bad? It's like, respect them, Kirk! And, tame the other one.
Mm-hmm. I have no strong thoughts.
I'll get back to you on it.
But yeah, it's a great moment, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Well done, everybody. At Your Turn Heather asks, am I the only one who noticed that Walker literally becomes Two-Face, complete with why won't you just die at the end?
Wow. Lamara, you may be the only one who has noticed that, but I'm delighted that you did. That's awesome.
Solomon Lane is a bit jokery, isn't he? There's a whole, I kind of see a whole Heath Ledger Joker kind of vibe to him with, even when he's locked up, he's controlling things that are going on around him.
A lot of stuff.
Skyfall did that as well, but they do it better here.
A lot of stuff has to go right for Solomon Lane and the Joker's plans to come to fruition. But
and Silver.
Yeah, but that's cool. Because he's presumably in solitary confinement. There's an idea in the film about how he's passed around from government to government. But does he remember all this stuff? Does he write it down anywhere at any point? It seems like a lot to remember.
I write it in my moleskin notebook.
Hey. Moleskin are good notebooks. I really like
those.
They
are good, very good notebooks, and they're used by nice people as well as evil masterminds.
Thank you, presumably, just to be clear.
But presumably, I've seen no evidence. I think Sean Harris is astonishing in these films. I really, really like what he does with Solomon Lane, and he's super creepy. And some of the scenes with him are some of my favourite bits. The shot with him in the van going underwater where the water's at a weird angle, and he's just there in his kind of straight jacket.
Yeah, that's a great shot.
It's an amazing shot. And his big creepy monologue is great. Go Sean Harris.
I do love a creepy monologue.
Yeah. I have a question. This is not related to your turn, Heather's question, but all right. So when the apostles make a deal with Ethan when they think he's John Lark,
yes,
to do this heist to break Solomon Lane out,
yes,
there is no reason for them. They don't need him because they have already figured the plan out.
Macquarie addresses this.
Oh, does he? Because yeah, I was very woolly on that whole
That was
section.
The big thing that I came out of not understanding, but I will listen to the interview. Yeah.
I guess the bigger question is, why does Ethan Hunt keep breaking things out of places for bad people? It does seem to be a bit of a habit with him. And I worry that, you know, it has been habit forming. Like, he got high on his own supply in the original Mission Impossible, you know, I've broken into CIA and got this list out.
Yeah.
And now he's just breaking in places to get things that were perfectly safe from everyone but him for bad, bad people.
Yeah.
But it's like he doesn't, yeah. With the Langley scene, like, only he can do that because it's so incredibly difficult. Whereas with this plan, it seems he just needs to back a truck up. It's kind of, like, he doesn't really, it doesn't require him to bring much to the table, their plan, as is. But as you say, I will listen to his reply.
Yeah, I can't remember what he said, okay. But it made sense. But it is interesting that this movie does, like I said, I think I may have said it in this one or in the regular podcast, leans into some mission tropes like the masks, and in other ways takes a step back from other things. I would say most people would identify a mission movie with an incredibly complex, detailed, intricate super heist. You know, so we have the silent one in the first movie. Mm-hmm. We have the Taurus underwater heist in Rogue Nation. Yeah. We have the Burj Khalifa scene. That's a heist in Ghost Protocol. There's nothing really like that in this, unless you count, of course, the extraction of Solomon Lane as a heist.
Yeah, I think that's meant to be the sort of the parallel in this one, I assume. But you're right, it doesn't feel as heisty. Although, of course, there are several layers of betrayal and complication going on within it, as it turns out. Mm-hmm. It's just they aren't immediately obvious. There isn't that element of planning a super complicated heist. Maybe it's just it turns out that to be super complicated.
And speaking of betrayal, we talked about it a little bit, but there's the first great mask moment with Wolf Blitzer, but I think the second mask moment is probably the best moment in the film for me, which is where August Walker thinks he's alone now with Solomon Lane.
Doesn't seem to be anyone around.
Precisely.
I knew you were going to do that.
And starts monologuing. Maybe even giving his old moustache a twirl there now and again.
Sly devil.
And then, of course, you realise that it's Benji all along. Or someone. We know that's someone underneath the mask. Mm-hmm. Well, we know it's Benji because we saw Benji getting the mask at long last. What did we make of that moment? I thought it was absolutely terrific. A nice rug pull.
Yes, I liked it a lot.
Yes.
I like the moment he realises, you know, when he's saying, you know, the IMF is just Halloween, it's just men with masks and turns around and goes, shit!
Wait a goddamn minute.
It's good.
I want them to do a scene in a Mission Impossible movie where everyone in the scene is not who they seem to be. And everyone's pulling masks off.
That's the Christmas party. That's the IMF Christmas party.
All right, just a couple of last ones to finish off with. Here's a question. Helen, I'm sorry, but this may exclude you. At Nordine Thomas asks, the lovely Miss Harahara excluded, of course. How long would it take for you guys at Empire to grow a decent moustache?
Yes, I will exclude myself happily from
and
that.
And still upset about the bad moustache removal CG in Justice League.
It's not just that he has a moustache. He has a moustache and stubble combo, which is a particularly fetching look on him. Mm-hmm. Like, moustache solo, like clean-shaven moustache, he would have looked, you know, ropey. But I like the swarthy moustache look.
I have a moustache currently. It is sadly more Walter White than August Walker. But
you and James can grow good moustaches.
They're okay.
Yeah, but it would take me a long time to grow something even remotely comparable to what Cavill has. And I'd probably take him like 3 days, bastard.
Essentially an afternoon.
He reloaded his upper lip. Yeah. And it was pretty quick.
And off he pops.
I think it must have been longer, otherwise I'm sure they could have accommodated any reshoots from any other films. It must have been a very long-term commitment.
So a whole bunch of people have asked this, but the question that the person whose name I have alighted on is James Stewart at JC Stew. And they asked basically, has the Mission Impossible franchise now eclipsed Bond and Bourne? Does it do essentially what Bond has been promising to do for a long time?
I came out of this and my first thought was, Danny Boyle must see this film and just be going, fuck. Like, because how do you top that with a Bond film at this point? Like, I was like, I don't know where you go. I think Bourne does something very different. Bourne, for me, is separate. I prefer the Bourne films, but they feel like a different beast to me.
I think psychologically, Bourne is a different beast. In terms of car chases and so on, I think this is right up there with the best of Bourne. And I obviously prefer it to Bond, but you knew I was going to say that. So.
Yes, I was, yeah.
But you're right, yeah, Danny Boyle has got to be like, holy shit, what do I do now?
Chris, what do you think Danny Boyle's thinking?
Oh, I love it. Oh, I absolutely love Mission Impossible Fallout. It's one of the greatest Mission Impossible movies I've ever seen. Brilliant stunts from Tom Cruise. Love it. Great.
That's amazing. And Danny Boyle actually came in to give us that brief interview.
To be honest, in fairness, Danny Boyle is probably fine. Danny Boyle probably has great plans for Bond and will be great at it.
Oh, come on, Helen. Constant Bond bashing.
It's
ridiculous.
A Bond bombardment.
I'm just trying to provide balance in the force and generally to the whole of the rest of the British media. So, you know, it's my one-woman crusade.
Yeah, I think this is the franchise that Bond's been trying to be for the last... Certainly now. I think probably from 3 onwards, certainly. But for me, there's been an escalation in the scale and the scope and the ambition of this franchise. And clearly they're accelerating. The distance between films is diminishing. I'd say they can only do something like this every 2 or 3 years. So I wouldn't... If there is going to be a 7, and I think there will be a 7. And I think, I would put money on Macquarie being back in the writer-director's chair.
Yeah.
For a trilogy within this franchise. Any other franchise we would have had, we'd be on Mission 12 by now.
Definitely.
And I feel we might have had the Law of Diminishing Returns
at
some
point. If we were on Mission 12, Tom Cruise would be legally dead. So
fine. He's got whatever Jackie Chan has and he can just survive.
He's made of rubber. Yeah.
Only in the last few years has it accelerated and roughly at the same pace as Bond with Skyfall and Spectre, both of which have always put a premium on doing practical stunts. But I think there's something about the fact that it's Cruise. And it's clearly Cruise.
It's interesting that we tended to credit that stunt work to Bourne, through the influence of Bourne rather than Mission Impossible. And I think that this will be much a bigger influence next time, for sure.
Any last notes, anything you want to say about this movie? Anything that stood out for you? Any characters that you feel we haven't shone the spotlight on? Any moments that you feel we haven't shone the spotlight on?
Wes Bentley.
Fake
hello,
out Wes,
hello
Bentley.
Wes Bentley.
Yeah, where have you been?
Yeah. That was fun.
We all expected him to be evil, right?
Yes, because he's Wes Bentley.
Yeah, and he's also married to the, you know, long-lost wife of...
Yeah.
So, yeah, you kind of did. But I was glad he wasn't. I thought that was nice.
I loved his bit at the end when he's like, doctor, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more. Yeah. It's like, okay.
It's because he uses the same phrase that Walker uses on the lift up the Tate Modern. He says, guardian angel. And he says, I'm her guardian angel. And then Wes Bentley says it as well. And you think, oh, he's got to be evil. But when you think about it, really, that would be serious long-term planning on the path part of Lane and Walker.
Very good planning. I feel like David Attenborough.
Yeah. You've got to marry her.
Aoife, I've been waiting to get you, Aoife. Look at Willoughby.
Marry Julia, make her fall in love with you, Aoife. Then, at a certain point, go to Kashmir. And when a man appears pretending to be a doctor, say, guardian angel.
I just feel this is very disrespectful to our Lord, David Attenborough. This is
You meant Sean Harris.
Yeah. No,
in Kashmir, the vegetation is very...
I would like to just give a shout out to the scene between... always to David Attenborough, but also to the scene between Julia and Luther, which I thought was really nice. Yeah. I really like that.
Yeah. Nice scene.
Yeah, that was...
And also the fact that it took place while defusing a bomb.
And I loved the fact that it was so right for her character that she was completely unfazed by the fact that he was asking her to help defuse a nuke. She didn't freak out. She was like, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah, she rocks.
Again, this is something I haven't asked Macquarie because part 2 hasn't happened yet, but I want to ask him about the ridiculousness of that bomb setup. That it can only be defused once both bombs have had the wires cut, and you have to have the detonator, but the detonator is a remote detonator, so it's attached to someone else. And
I did love the fact, though, that they had the little conversation. They couldn't get in touch with Ethan because he's too far away. They had the little conversation, and they basically just decided to trust. He's going to get it done, but he's going to get it done at the absolute last minute. So that's what we're going to do.
How close were we? Yeah. The usual.
Are you sure you want to do it in 2 seconds? That's a second we're never going to get back.
Yeah.
It's, all right, we'll do it in one.
I thought that was a beautiful little expression of teamwork and trust and his competence. I thought it was a really, really lovely moment.
And I love that it's hanging out of his mouth as he's hanging off the cliff and he just spits it out.
Can I just say as well that we saw this for the first time. I think we saw it on the IMAX screen at Cineworld Leicester Square, which is an amazing IMAX screen. If you get a chance to see an IMAX movie in London, obviously the BFI IMAX is great, but this is also amazing. And the end, and we're talking about the idea that it's Cruise doing these stunts. It sets it apart from Bond and from Bourne. And you can literally see it. It's Tom Cruise flying that helicopter. Mm-hmm. And it's Tom Cruise hanging off that the big mountain, that big cliff, which is in Norway. There's a little bit of chicory-pokery going on there. And it's Tom Cruise climbing onto the rock at the end of the movie. And as tense and as gripping as everything else in the film was, it's that shot at the end that both Helen and I were reaching out towards the screen and waving him back on. Just lean over a little bit more, Tom.
Move away from the edge, Tom.
Yeah.
Jesus.
There's something about people being on the edge. It gets me. It keeps me sharp on the edge where I got to be. But yeah, that honestly, conniptions. I'm having conniptions just thinking about
he
it.
He was too close. Just move away from the
close
edge.
Close to the edge.
Did anyone else think of Cliffhanger during that sort of final 20 minutes? Or specifically 10 minutes? I don't know. Just made me want to watch
it. I thought of Uncharted.
Right.
It felt like a sequence from Uncharted.
I just thought Craig Fairbrass was going to turn up and start commentating a football match.
Well, that's it for our Mission Impossible Fallout spoiler special. Our next spoiler special, apart from part 3 of this spoiler special with Chris McQuarrie, will be out next week, is Ant-Man and the Wasp with the director Peyton Reed and the producer Stephen Broussard. So keep your ears peeled for that one as well. Until that auspicious occasion, and the regular podcast is out every Friday, as you know, it is goodbye from IMF agent Helen O'Hara.
Goodbye.
IMF agent Nick August Desemlian.
Goodbye.
That was
a mini reload.
And IMF janitor James Dyer.
This podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to clamber up a building in London whilst Lolly Adefope works unaware on her laptop. Thanks for listening. See you next time.